Agile Coffee for Humans, Episode 11.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
Welcome back to another episode of the Agile Coffee for Humans podcast. It's a crossover.
Yeah, so Victor and I, this is Ryan Ripley, got together and decided, hey, we had so much fun talking before, let's do a crossover of the two podcasts, place the episode in each feed so that he can introduce his listeners to Agile for Humans and I can introduce our listeners over here to Agile Coffee. There's a lot of good crossover. There's a lot of topics that we both cover. It's a very human-centric podcast, what Victor and his crew has put together, and I think it's a great fit, and I hope you guys give it a shot, and after this, go out and listen to Victor's archive and check out Agile Coffee and continue listening for all of their great topics and guests. So, Victor, thanks for having me and for putting together this crossover. Really appreciate it.
Where do we contact you best, Ryan? I know you've got the website, agileanswerman.com. What's your Twitter handle?
Yeah, so I'm Ryan Ripley on Twitter. AgileAnswerMan.com or Ryan@RyanRipley.com is the email address. Please feel free to reach out and continue the conversation.
And in addition to Ryan, we have another good friend of ours, John Jorgensen, on with us today. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing good. In fact, I think you could say I'm upgraded. I'm very, very upgraded tonight.
John 2.0.
John
2.0.
Can be...
You just call me that for now.
I'm just going to call you 2.0 tonight, then.
2.0 can be reached on Twitter at WaterScrumbon. So this is pretty exciting for me. We've always done these coffees face-to-face, so this is my first virtual lean coffee. I don't expect it to go off completely without a hitch, but I do expect to have a lot of fun. I see that all the cards that are assigned to John are now being assigned to 2.0.
Very good.
So Lean Coffee was started a few years back, and it's a very lightweight, agendaless meeting format. Started by Jim Benson, Jeremy, up in the Seattle area. And they were just kind of tired of doing all the stuff that goes along with putting together a conference or even a meeting, getting a speaker and having someone else put together the agenda, all that. So they decided to make it very lightweight using lean principles and have the agenda emerge out of what people want to talk about. So in most cases, we sit around a table and we use index cards, just 3x5 index cards, and everyone will write 0, 1 or more topics that they want to. And the reason that we use thick markers on an index card is because you can't fit a whole paragraph on there. So it's just a few words. After everyone's contributed their topics, what we do is we just give a little bit of a context to each topic. And I might say, for example, my first card today says organizational psychotherapist, the new coach, because I read a blog post. Bob Marshall put out a blog post lately, and I wanted to talk about how the coaching is really going maybe more toward, in his opinion, toward just a therapist role. So that's an example of how to put some context to a card. And then what we do is after we each give context to our cards, we do some dot voting. In our case, maybe 3 votes apiece. Then we stack rank them. So whatever has the most dots goes on top, whatever has the fewest goes on the bottom. And hey, isn't that nice? Because now you're not talking about all the stuff that no one wants to talk about. You're talking about the important things first. And then you set up a personal Kanban board, which is simply 3 columns. Left to right, it's to do, doing, and done. And then give ourselves a time box of, in this case, 6 minutes or so. We'll pull the first card in and talk about it for 6 minutes and see if there's staying power to that topic, if we want to continue on, or if we want to pull the next card in after that. That's it in a nutshell, a rather big nutshell. Sometimes I talk too long about lean coffee, but I can't tell you how excited I am to use it. And I always find new applications for it, too, whether it's in the workplace, in the community at meetups, or in the case of our podcast. It's a great tool to have. Well, having said all that, I see 7 topics out there. I'm just going to read them off. So again, I put the first topic up there of my own. It says organizational psychotherapist, the new coach. And I gave a little bit of a summary of it, but I was reading Bob Marshall. He goes by Flowchain Sensei on Twitter. He just wrote a short post called Why Me? And it goes into the topic of, hey, I call myself a coach or may call myself a consultant, but is that quite right? I think that maybe I'm more of a therapist, and here's why. So I thought, hey, that's a pretty compelling topic. Let's talk about it. The next one I put up is called Agile Games, Simulations, and Learning Activities. Agile Games for short. I put that up there because there's a handful of games and other activities that I use when I do trainings, and I kind of wanted to share those with you guys, see if we're talking about the same games or if you have others that I forgot to add, but about five or six that I go to all the time. The next one, Ryan, is yours. It says, the business side of Agile, how we justify the investment in agility.
Yeah, so this is more around the better, faster, cheaper false promise of Agile and how we should actually frame out to the business side of the fence, if such a thing exists, which sometimes it does, but framing out to them what exactly they're investing in, what they're going to get, and some of the levers they have to pull in order to enhance or even be destructive towards that investment.
All right. We have a few from John, or 2.0, I should say.
2.0.
The HR side of Agile, performance reviews, raises, and transparency.
Yeah, so it's long been a topic, I guess, since the days of Edward Deming, that individual written performance reviews on an annual or semi-annual basis are actually demoralizing and ineffective. And I believe that actually inside of the Agile movement, this is something that's becoming more broadly understood and accepted as Agile practice to avoid. And so I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about that and maybe gather some insider consensus on how our community is progressing in that respect.
Cool. How about the Agile transformation, the rest of the story?
Yeah, so there is an Agile transformation, I think, a change of mindsets and certain things that the software development team is expected to do. However, an Agile transformation across the enterprise, I think, involves an equal amount of change and effort on the part of management and executives in terms of removing structural impediments. And so I'd like to explore that a little bit.
2.0 has two more topics. One is crossing the line, push and pulling hair.
Right. So I think what I'm seeing in Agile coaching right now is that as an Agile coach, you're trying to encourage teams to adopt new principles, values, and practices. And there's a point where a coach can cross over the line and maybe get substantial blowback. And so there's kind of a dance in this coaching that I see where you push to a certain extent and then you pull back and kind of let the team recover. And so this is a very delicate art as far as I can tell so far, and interested in other people's experience with it.
I have Aerosmith's Living on the Edge song as you're playing in my head as you're doing that. And finally, you have Ken's complaint, trademarking Scrum Group.
Yeah, so about a week ago, Ken Schwaber published an article on his blog related to how the Scrum Alliance is currently pursuing the trademarking or copywriting, I think it's trademarking, of the word Scrum and Group. Particularly related to a dispute I think that they had with a Scrum users group in Orlando, Florida some months or years ago. And it's generating quite a number of comments on his blog by well-established dignitaries in the field. And it could be much ado about nothing, or it could be a very important turning point in the Agile community. So it might be interesting to kind of get some people's viewpoints on this one.
Yep. We've got the seven topics up there. Let's give them four votes apiece. There's a lot tiered that I kind of want to hear. We're probably going to get to run through all of them anyway, but I just love to vote. So we'll take a minute and do that. Ta-da!
So for those of you not familiar with this format, what Victor's doing right now is he's counting up the votes, taking the spreadsheet we're using, the Google Doc, ordering it in rank order that we have voted on the topics, and it looks like the HR side of Agile has won out as our number one topic, I think he's going to start the clock and we're going to fire away. Do I have it right, Vic?
That's exactly it. So, John, you've got it. The floor is yours with the HR side of Agile, performance reviews, raises, and transparency.
Right. So, I think Edward Deming was pretty clear in his statements about his reasons why people don't benefit or organizations don't benefit by doing semi-annual and annual performance reviews of individual workers. And the two that come to mind are that when there is a delay between an action of a worker and the review or evaluation and feedback of that action, it really doesn't contribute to that person's improvement in their behavior. And it also creates a culture of fear and lack of risk-taking and innovation. But even worse still, there's individuals doing the best that they can in a system that needs to be optimized rather than people being optimized. And so those are the reasons I think that he gave for discouraging written semi-annual or annual performance reviews. In the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, I suppose, I've seen postings on LinkedIn, and I'm sure that Harold Shinsato has posted in his blog a couple of papers that have shown how actually companies expose themselves to legal liabilities rather than protect themselves by perpetuating this mispractice of written performance reviews. But most recently, what I've noticed is that when you look at an organization's readiness to adopt Agile principles and values, that having team-based reward systems and team-based performance metricing, that's an indicator of where a company is in their preparations for transformation, if you will. And, you know, I've been reading lately the books written by Ken Schwaber, and he also makes indications that individual performance reviews are a counter indicator for readiness for Agile. So in my mind, it's very black and white, and even though this is like conventional wisdom in the Agile community, I have yet to see an organization that's actually adopted team-based reviews and reward systems, other than just a small handful of examples like, I don't know, Holacracy and Zappos and others. So anyways, I was just kind of wondering, in everybody else's minds, is this something, you know, the individual reviews, is this something that people see as anachronistic? And if so, like, why do we tolerate it so much? Because the years just keep rolling by that I see it, you know, further enshrined in organizational development and governance structures, which is kind of disappointing. Is it changing, or what will it take, I wonder, you know, to change this?
Here's the grand experiment with doing a lean coffee over Skype where we're not seeing each other. No, well put. I've been, as Ryan knows and John knows as well, I've been between engagements for a little while now. So I've been doing a bunch of interviews, and I've interviewed for a director position. It's still in progress, so I'll keep it at that. But I've had to not only address that question myself, but also kind of examine what would it take for me to kind of put my chips on the table and say, this is what I think needs to be done. I mean, this is the way that, you know, not to be kind of prescriptive about it, but I think that you're right, John. It should be very team-based, and that's what I'm saying whenever I'm doing any kind of a formal or even an informal interview with people now, is how do you go about getting across the performance of the team? And I say that because I'm not... in my role, in my, hopefully my role, I'm not handing out a performance, but I'm communicating. I'm working with the team members and the individuals in some cases, I would guess, but working with the teams to say, okay, how is it that we are performing and how can we make improvements together? I think that a lot of the individual performance conversations and or situations are probably handled within the team. At least that's my ideal, and that's what I'm saying with the people that I'm interviewing. And then any other kind of the typical 360-degree feedback is very much, you know, how can the organization help you? How can you? What are you finding in the organization that you can help bring to us outside of our regular daily talks? But really, it's how do we as a team give ourselves a performance, an honest and appropriate performance review?
So I think if the goal is to change behavior in an org, you start with the facts, right? So when I think of a performance review, and I actually am a director in a Fortune 500 company, I spend a lot of time on this every year. And what I've always felt about these performance reviews is that it's always an after-the-fact discussion. I'm talking to someone about the previous year at a point in time where we can't do any corrective action. Mm-hmm. And so I find that to be lacking in value. I'd rather support the person in the position and role that they're fulfilling at a point in time when they need it, right? So I'd rather have the conversation at a point in time where I can provide coaching, direction, you know, whatever that person needs in that moment to position them for future success. And so I think that's the initial, that's the smell, right? That's the problem. It's the after-the-fact nature of a review.
Right.
If you look at the statistics, in the United States, 6% of the Fortune 500 have dropped these annual review processes. Accenture being the most recent, ultimately they decided the time and money spent was not getting the goal that they were trying to drive, which is improve the performance of their employees. Because again, it was an after-the-fact measurement that was doing a forced ranking and creating a way to distribute a bonus that they felt really only, which basically the process only helped the narcissistic and the self-promoters. You know, that's the issue there. I'd also add, you know, companies like Deloitte, Microsoft, Adobe, Gap, in the medical device world, Medtronic, they've all gone to a lightweight performance assessment type system because of these observations. So the answer to the question of how do we make this more pervasive is give it time. The facts are proving out. Companies are moving forward. 6% of the Fortune 500 is making the change. And the statistics and the numbers and the studies are coming in and showing, you know, management can easily spend at least 200 hours a year on these type of efforts. In a firm of 10,000 employees, it could cost $35 million to that firm just to do that activity. As those numbers,
what a huge amount of waste.
Absolutely. And so as those numbers become more public to boards, and as people really go dig into their processes and validate those numbers, I think you'll find companies very interested in leaning that out, because those are real dollars that management's spending when they could be doing strategy, when they could be doing future vision, when they could be doing coaching and other activities would actually bring value back to the firm.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A couple, I don't know, months ago, I guess, I decided to start Googling on this topic, and I realized that a friend of mine who from Japan, who had, you know, worked for Fortune 500 companies such as IBM, had written an article in the Wall Street Journal about this. His name's Brad Hall. And I'm very confident that he knows nothing about the Agile movement per se, or Scrum, or anything like that, project management related. But as you say, Ryan, I think you can be framework agnostic and still arrive at the irrefutable conclusion that these kinds of way after the fact reviews are worthless, because it's no longer actionable. And, you know, looking at the size of the waste, I mean, my gosh, you could probably sustain the entire Agile coaching industry on a very small fraction of the savings that you would get from eliminating this archaic practice. So I think you're right. It maybe doesn't take evangelizing from a bunch of agilists to change this trend, but just the triumph of reason will eventually bring it to pass.
Well, and if you tie it back to the agile paradigm, right, you would basically look at it as running a retrospective at the end of a waterfall project. And what good would that do you?
Yeah, just like a retrospective in a sprint, you know, 2 weeks delay, or in the moment, the day of is the time, you know, strike while they're hot.
Great. That was topic number one. What do you out there have to say about this topic or anything that we talk about? Use the hashtag on Twitter, TellAgileCoffee, and become part of the conversation. Next up, we have a topic that's called The Business of Agile. Ryan, this is yours. How we justify the investment in agility?
Yeah, so this is a very quick tee up, and I hope you guys have some experience with this. I'm sure you do. You know, in many circles, when you talk about why we're doing agile, sometimes it's in the reaction to an issue. Sometimes it's a reaction to an observation. Sometimes it's, hey, Agile's the new shiny and a consulting firm said we need to do this. In any case, when they're making justifications to the people who control the financials of a company, I'm hearing a lot of better, faster, cheaper, and I don't necessarily agree with it. And instead, I'd rather tell the story more accurately, where there is a heavy upfront investment, there are things that will cost more, but in the long run, you can save through quality and other such measures. And it's really just an open discussion or perhaps question around, have you guys seen the better, faster, cheaper completely blow up in the faces of people who are trying to do an agile transformation? And what have you found to be successful when you're speaking to the business decision makers and those who are holding the financial reins when you're trying to convince them that Agile is a good investment?
Well, I honestly think it would be really good comedy if it weren't tragedy. But what I see happening is, like you say, when people don't know a lot about their own enterprise's problems and they don't know anything about Agile, generally what they latch onto is the faster part of better, faster, cheaper. And the most common misunderstanding or misguided approach is to say, so faster means more and more means more. I like more. So we want higher velocities. And the way that we get there is we stuff more things into work in progress and we get more. And what keeps coming back to them is that you get nothing when you max out at 100% utilization of your individuals or teams. And so the big discovery or epiphany is that by limiting WIP, lowering to a reasonable range of utilization, like 75 to 85%, all of a sudden they do actually get more, and they get it at a sustainable pace, and they get it in a predictable cadence. And that's, I think, where the investment starts to pay off. But it's usually in spite of the approach and the objectives and actual pain that was besetting the enterprise. And so it's kind of like a windfall more than it is the wisdom of business leaders understanding themselves, understanding what Agile can do for them, and then making a beeline for it. That's my experience so far.
Yeah, and I often think it needs to be much more of a case of outside of the development group. Like a lot of times, my impression is that leaders in businesses just think of Agile as something that's going to help the developers, as you said, John, get their stuff done faster. But they really just only contain their thought, the sphere of thought, to that side of the building, the developers, the everything that goes along with developing and getting software out. But really, it has to be an investment in Agile up and down throughout the organization. And for me, that's the question that I grapple with, is how do you, short of just saying, you know, hey, this is change and change isn't easy, but it's going to going to be a completely different mindset for your organization. How do you get them to swallow that pill?
Is it a well-understood problem? And in some of the areas, I don't think it is. You know, trying to explain to a company, yeah, we're going to put XP in, and your developers are going to become proper professional engineers in the software space. That's great. And I think XP is so fundamental to everything that we do that I don't think you should even try this without the core XP practices within your dev teams. You know, it is just fundamental. But at the same time, the business has to provide co-located product owners who are dedicated to teams. That's mm-hmm. expensive. From a DevOps perspective, continuous integration, continuous deployment, all these things are incredibly expensive. Most large companies aren't doing them. So you have that upfront investment. If teams are limiting WIP, you need more teams to get the same portfolio, quote unquote, done as what was perceived in the past. That's expensive.
Well, Brian, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but on the back end, we have a lot of value. We're not doing months and months of integration at the end of a project. We're not doing months and months of product change requests and an additional months of testing slash defect remediation slash fixes. You know, we're able to cut off there. We're not doing the 50% of the project that brought no value and that the users were never going to use. So we're cutting the tail off on the back end of a project, but there is heavy upfront spending. And if we could actually wrap our heads around some of that and tell a compelling story, I think we can remove some of the disappointment that is perhaps coming with many agile transformations.
Yeah, I was going to say, Ryan, I mean, as long as we're stacking the costs of an agile transformation, why don't we go where the numbers are crazy huge? And what I mean by that is taking an offshored, outsourced labor force and bringing it all back on shore, in-house, co-located. I mean, we're talking about, I don't know, what I hear accountants say is that 3-to-1, in other words, the cost of an offshored full-time person is about one-third as expensive as an onshore co-located developer. And so we're saying we want you to invest 300% of what you're currently doing. And I don't think that any company that could be described as fat, happy, and stupid would be willing to make that leap of faith. I think that it takes a company that is literally down on its knees saying, help me, I'm dying, that is willing to take that kind of an extreme step. And so there's certain, I don't know, I guess you could say crossing of the chasm that is impossible when you casually approach making an agile transformation. But having said those extreme things, I will also say that comparing a pre-transformation enterprise, or at least the software development part of it, to a post-transform software development organization is like night and day. And so a 300% investment, I think, actually has a much more handsome ROI than what companies or enterprises are putting up with today. So I'm thinking orders of magnitude more profitability and return on investment than what enterprises are used to. So the investment, I think, is warranted. But, again, what's preventing them is not the ROI. It's the lack of introspection, you know, on a numbers basis, on a profitability basis, of where they're at today, what they stand to lose in terms of competitive advantage by staying the same, and then what they have to gain by completely reinventing themselves.
Yeah. You had mentioned, competitive advantage, and I think that's huge. I wanted to see if anyone knows if there's any attempts being made at finding out what a payback period is. So we talked about ROI, but also what's the payback period of these upfront investments. So if it only takes a year or so, it might be more doable to most of the C-suite execs. But if it takes something like 2 or 3 years on that order, then it's a harder sell, right?
I think it depends on the percent of return But also another compelling factor is going to be how fast does that return begin? And that could also be an interesting way to present it. You know, in a typical program, you know, let's say it takes 12 to 18 months to actually get revenue coming back in. On an agile transformation, month one or two, you can start seeing an uptick depending on what kind of activities you're undertaking. And so that I think the time to that initial return is important, but then again, that the percentage of return and over the number of years is also critical. There's not a lot of work out there, as far as I know, in this space. However, I think this is an important topic, and it's time that we do start speaking in business terms back to these organizations if we really want to see true traction increase.
I agree, 100%.
Yeah, and speaking to the payback period, the more that I work with organizations that have thousands of employees rather than hundreds or dozens, the more that I'm seeing that turnaround is much slower. So rather than weeks or months, I really do think you're looking at years.
Yeah.
Even if we're talking about co-located, onshore, full-time, permanent employees, mindsets take a long time to change.
Right.
And, you know, your best case scenario from what I've seen is about 8 months, 6 to 8 months for somebody who's a real gung-ho, like a scrum master who used to be maybe like a BA or a project manager. If you take the more skeptical, like tech leads or other types of team members, it can be a long, long time before they decide that they're going to change the way that they see the world. So unfortunately, when you're talking about Fortune 1000s and Fortune 500s, I would say rather than overbuilding expectations, brace yourself for a two-year turnaround.
Good. I mean, not good, but I think that brings us to the end of the topic.
Yeah,
good stuff. That one went a little bit long, but yeah, I agree. Underscoring what Ryan just said, it's about time that we had that conversation. Let's move on, though, to our next card. We have Ken's complaint. So why don't you lead us off there, 2.0?
Yeah, sure. So in this blog, you know, Ken Schwaber is pointing out that all the time that he was the president of Scrum Alliance, I would suppose starting in 2004 and going for a couple of years thereafter, with the exception of where he was hospitalized due to a bicycling accident, he had instructed the staff at Scrum Alliance and the legal staff to not pursue the trademarking of Scrum terms, in hopes that having a completely unfettered access to it, you know, it's in like the, what do they call that, the commons?
Creative Commons?
You know, usage. Mm. Creative Commons, right, but it's protected by Creative Commons, so you don't have to think twice about, you know, if I say something wrong or use this without permission, is somebody going to come get me? And then that would proliferate it. You know, the more that people have freedom to use something, then the more inclined they are to use it and tell their friends. And I think that that's really what's happened, is that you've seen Scrum kind of mushroom all over the place. But what's going on now, it seems, and I say this because I don't think that anyone who represents the Scrum Alliance has really given the counterpoint to Ken's argument that they are seeking to restrict the usage of the word Scrum and group, and it's only his speculation or the speculation of other commenters on that thread that they want to bring a lawsuit against some Scrum users group somewhere because they didn't ask permission to call themselves a Scrum users group. And I guess where I'm most interested in this is if the organization, Scrum Alliance or any other entity, actually does start trying to restrict the usage of its terms or overly commercializes their knowledge or their terms, and I don't know where that boundary is, by the way, but over-commercialization can lead to an actual abandonment of the concepts and the terms. And Ken wrote something that was fairly interesting there, which was actually, I hope that they do abandon, you know, what we're calling Scrum today and go beyond it. Not knowing as much about Ken Schwaber as I probably could, would have not thought that he would say something like that. I consider him sort of one of the fathers of Scrum. But I think he has an agile mindset of, you know, the sooner agile dies, the sooner Scrum dies, the sooner we can move on to whatever lies beyond it. And I think, I'm not saying that we're there yet. I think that there is value in the ideas, and the rest of the world is still barely catching up with us in Scrum and other popular forms of Agile. But if there really is a movement inside the organizers of Scrum Alliance to try to be very restrictive and police the use of the word Scrum, I think that they will see a very sharp turn in the way that people reflect that brand of it. And particularly Tobias Mayer, by the way, chimed in on this thread, so you can imagine how inflammatory it got, was, you know, pointing out things like, you know, the renewal fees for some of Scrum Alliance's certifications and whether that's excessive commercialization or not. And I think that that this topic is a watershed moment, because there's a lot of opinions that are forming pretty strongly, and there's a counter movement. I would call it, like Mike Cohn's recent Front Row Agile offering called Letting Go of Knowing, where people are saying, you know what, there's been enough of the religious wars over different frameworks, and if we truly drink the Kool-Aid that we sell to others around being introspective and empirically based, when we go to different conferences throughout the world where Agile and its many flavors and brands is being presented, strongly consider going to a session that is something that you are least inclined to go learn more about in the interest of broadening your own perspective. So I think Scrum Alliance has a lot to lose by going the wrong way with this. I don't know if it's as iconic as it's making itself out to be, but only time will tell. And I don't know, how would it strike either of you if, you know, the patent office were actually to award the control of the word Scrum and group to the Scrum Alliance? Would that be small potatoes, or would that be something that kind of feels a little bit, commercialistic or over-controlling?
I've listened, I think you've teed it up very well, John, and I've gone through Ken's post. I read it a few days ago. There's been a lot of new comments out there. I'm not so worried about this. I think cool. this is actually, it turns out Scrum User Group was a registered trademark back in 2009 by the Scrum Alliance. This really isn't a wholly new thing. And it looks like, when you look at Scrum Alliance, full disclosure here. I have almost every Scrum.org certification. I also have the CSM and the CSPO through the Scrum Alliance. So I'm invested in both sides. I think both of them have a great product. I'm not necessarily favorable of one over the other. I think they're both different, and that's great. And so I have exposure to both. And so now that that's out there, I mean, I will say Scrum Alliance invests quite a bit into the user group community. And so
that's true.
And so there is a lot of investment in there. Now, does that give them the right to trademark that phrase or term? Well, I don't know, but it's already done. And so I agree with, with that said, I am a big fan of Ken Schwaber and what he's done for the Scrum community. And so I am concerned with what he's brought up, but as you look into it more, I don't see the overriding problem, especially since this is already a done deal. And given how Scrum Alliance has already managed their relationship with the Scrum user groups and their investments, I don't know the impact. It's now, if someone were to reach out and try to trademark the word Scrum,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's where I would start. I would donate money to the campaign to stop that. But as far as, you know, Scrum Alliance trying to put some kind of governance or framework around how they interact through the Scrum user group communities, especially with their investments in those communities, I'm not going to get excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and, you know, when the Scrum users groups were proliferating, you know, I was involved with the chartering of one of them, as was Vic, and I didn't find that they were overly controlling or restrictive in any way at that point. I guess only theoretically, you know, they do have legal footing to exercise control in the future if they should want to. And that's kind of a specter that in some people's minds is looming. But on the other side of the coin, as you mentioned, I've seen Scrum Alliance be extremely generous with some of the local Agile events, such as Southern California Agile Open and the recent Agile Coach Camp US West. And I expect that they will continue along that tradition of being generous as a sponsor to the grassroots Agile events that spring up from time to time. So I don't feel that they have a bad track record of wielding the influence that they have through money.
Yep.
And like you, I see Scrum Org and Scrum Alliance. I have certifications in both, like you, Ryan. And I do like there being more than one organization, and I do like the differences that are endemic to each of those organizations.
Hot topic. Well, you know, I have Manny Gonzalez's phone number. We can give him a call, but I think it's after hours. He might not pick up. So we'll just let that one go.
I think Ken actually did write a letter and is waiting for Manny to maybe engage in a conversation rather than email.
Yeah.
And I suspect good things will come of that.
Yeah, and that's what I want to sit back and take a look at, too. What does Scrum Alliance come out and say? What are their intentions? And once you have that compared to with what, you know, with what Mr. Schwaber's posted, I think we'll have a good picture of what's going on and the right next steps forward. At this point, though, I mean, I'm always interested in what Ken has to say. You know, I think he's clearly he's given so much to the community through Scrum, he and Jeff Sutherland, that whenever they speak out on something so passionately, it's worth taking notice. I'm glad he did it. I'm glad he raised awareness. And now it's really in Scrum Alliance's court to just come back and reiterate their commitment to the communities, their commitment to the sponsorships, and how they're going to continue that down the road.
Right.
Yep.
All right. So again, listeners, what do you have to say? Use the hashtag TellAgileCoffee and chime in. What do you think about the idea of trademarking Scrum user group? Let's move on then to our fourth topic today, which is also, John, this is yours, crossing the line, push and pulling hair. I'm living on the edge.
Yeah, and so honestly, I mean, levity aside, this is a very delicate thing to do. I've seen Agile coaches basically cross the line, and it's the last thing that they do at an organization, meaning that they're asked not to come back. And so, you know, as I'm interfacing with teams, and I'm seeing that they are not necessarily adopting practices that you would identify as being akin to Scrum or Agile or XP, I can see also that there's a breaking point where as a coach, you need to pull back and give them time to absorb the message and what it means to them and the value proposition, and to start learning more about a practice before they can actually adopt it. And just to give you kind of a sample or an example, my teams know what test-driven development is, and they have certain, you know, definition of done requirements that require, you know, JUnit coverage of, like, let's say 100% of the classes, 95% of the methods, 85% of the lines of code, and 80% of the branches, just so we're perfectly crystal clear on, you know, what their definition might be. And then rather than doing test-driven or test-first development, they write their code and play catch-up, you know, with the unit tests. And they are very transparent with me when I, you know, ask them, well, this could not possibly happen if you're doing test-driven development. You know, would come back to say, we are not doing test-driven development right here. And, you know, not denigrate it, not discard it, but just simply say, you know, here's where we're at. At that point, because they're honest and forthcoming and appreciate the point that I'm making, I kind of take that as my cue to say, okay, let them play catch up because this is the last day of the sprint. There's already enough pressurization in this chamber. Let's start afresh tomorrow and, you know, in the new sprint, see if there's ways that we can improve. In the retrospective, you know, propose an experiment and try to learn. There are other coaches that would push further, would demand maybe commitments or start to sermonize. And I think that can be very dangerous with the team-coach relationship. But in any case, it seems that this is an art rather than a science. And, you know, I'm as aware of the agile coaching canon as I suppose everyone else listening to this podcast is, you know, and I, to be honest, I feel like there's a little bit of a dearth of knowledge on, like, where do you draw that line or how frequently should you cross it. It seems like a real gut feel kind of a thing for me, which, of course, might be just one aspect of the profession that I have to learn to live with, because there is guesswork when you're going on just feelings like that. But I'm interested in how other agile coaches develop that sense of awareness of how and where to draw the line and how frequently to cross it or not. So if anybody has ideas around that, I'd be interested in hearing them.
Yeah, John, I think it's an important topic, and it's one that I used to be really, and to an extent, I still am really horrible at. And I've made a lot of mistakes in this area, and some of them were very painful. You know, you can push way too hard. You can really turn off a person who was initially open to your ideas. And then by pushing to the point to where they just say, you know what, I don't want to engage in this anymore. I'm going to go back to what I was doing. You've destroyed an opportunity there. And that was something that it took a little while for me to learn. Because you can get so passionate about these ideas. You know, you can, once you get it, it's hard to take your foot off the gas when you're thinking about agile things. It's also hard to remember that none of us started out as agilists, right? Most of us have some kind of other background. We've spent years on this. I've spent 10, 11, 12 years thinking about these topics. I still don't have them figured out, but I trust in them now. And now to expect someone who just learned about it yesterday to come around to my way of thinking so quickly is just, it's asinine, but at the same time, it happens daily. And so something that actually Zach Boniker forced on me almost was a book. He said, Ryan, you've got to read Crucial Conversations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've got to devour this book. Stop pushing. Start asking the right questions at the right time to receptive people. And that's made a lot of difference. I've also been greatly influenced by George Dinwiddie. He's been on the Agile for Humans podcast a few times. And he always comes back to the what's the need that you're addressing for the person. And Bob Marshall's really, he's known for that as well.
Yeah.
You know, meeting the need. And so you're no longer pushing. you're meeting a need of the person, and you're acting in that moment. And I think it's just a great framework. It's hard. It's not always easy to remember to do that. But I think those two approaches, right? So the crucial conversations, if you're an Agile coach, I know it's almost becoming a cliche to recommend that book. It's almost like recommending Drive at an Agile conference. But crucial conversations, I mean, I have it in audible.com format, and I also have the hard copy that is just highlighted and written in. You just have to listen to it over and over and over, internalize those lessons, and start conversing in that way. And then you can stop pushing, and you can stop getting fired and asked to leave, and you can just have the right conversation in the right way at the right moment to a receptive person. And I think things go a lot better.
Yes, and that phrase, meeting the need, that George Dinwiddie and Barb Marshall reference, sounds to me like it's taken from nonviolent communication. The name of the author escapes me, but I'll find it for the show notes. And that's really it, is that people's actions and the way that they create story and meaning for themselves is very much emergent from the needs that they're trying to have met or needs that are going unmet. And, yeah, I think, you know, as I look at, well, you know, why is it then that I go maybe past that, or that I'm tempted to go past simply meeting the need, is I think honestly it's that I believe that there is a certain standard of, you know, transformation pace that isn't being met, and maybe I'm actually allowing myself to self-critique and say, okay, so as an Agile coach, you're falling down on the job if you haven't gotten the team from point A to point B by date C. And that's really, I think, overstepping the bounds of the role of a coach. And so kind of getting caught up in the heat of the moment to say, oh, gosh, look how far we've fallen behind. Let's push them along faster is where, as a coach, I've lost sight of the job number one, meeting the needs and having the circumstances become one of learning and discovery for the people that do the work, rather than me instructing them where to go and what they should know by now. So getting out of the way, getting out of my own way, and especially out of the team's way, I think is probably one of the things that I need to do. But crucial conversations, you're right. I think that that's a good one to go back to.
Yeah, very good. Belongs in the canon of books. You should probably put it up on Don Gray's bookshelf, too.
Oh, it has a prominent place on that shelf.
All right. The next topic, I'm going to segue into it because I feel like there's enough of an overlap. And it's the topic itself is called Organizational Psychotherapist. The new coach. And it was it's based on a blog post that Bob Marshall had written, Why Me, where he's not really lamenting anything about necessarily himself, but rather he's talking about the state of, you know, what we call coaching in the industry, and how his bottom line is that he's no longer really a coach, but he sees himself, his stance, as that of more of a therapist, in that a person who helps people deal with these emotional aspects or mental aspects of situations by talking about these aspects and situations. So he says, you know, he doesn't want to be coming off as selling or giving advice or coaching. He just tries to listen and hold the space and empathize so that other people can kind of come up and discover these solutions themselves. And I wanted to see if any of you guys are familiar with the post, and if not, just how that resonates with you.
Well, this is 2.0. I'm not familiar with the post, but what you said about holding space as a therapeutic approach is part and parcel the role of the new coach or the Agile coach, in my opinion. And what I'm referencing, gosh, I'll have to go and find it, but a colleague where I work posted this thing about, I think it was like a kind of a hospice nurse or like a, you know, final stages of life nurse holding space for a family that is losing, you know, a loved one.
I read that also. I'll try to dig it up and put it in the show notes, but
No, that's a must read, in my opinion, for anybody that's trying to coach or assist a group through some kind of transformation. And it really kind of goes back to Harris Owen's two or three books about cultural transformation, in my opinion, which is that there is certain rites of passage rites, or actual mourning that you go through. You mourn the loss of the past or the old ways of being, and you celebrate the renewal or opening, you know, of possibilities. And the coach is the person that kind of holds that space for the possibilities, and lets the individual or the team or the organization find its way through to that space. And it's very powerful. I can't claim to fully understand it yet. It's only because I've had life experiences that resemble the one in that article that I can appreciate the value of holding space. I guess I would say it's a non-invasive approach to assisting that is not that predominant in other areas of our society. So maybe that's why the article was so enlightening to me. But you know, I don't have a couch. I don't have team members come and lie down and tell me about their dreams or their life. When I have one-on-ones with individual scrum masters, oftentimes they do tell me about how they feel like they've found their calling, and you know, post retirement, they want to continue this kind of work. And that the values of servant leadership are things that they have carried with them, you know, throughout their life, and that this is something that resonates very strongly with them on a personal level. And so to that degree, I guess you could say, there is an amount of exchange of authentic, you know, feeling and maybe, you know, philosophical views of one's place in the world.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't always understand where Bob Marshall's going with his posts, but I hope to someday grow up into the kind of person who does. Does that make sense? I hope.
Totally.
I love reading his stuff. I really try to get my brain wrapped around it. This is one that resonated well. I actually give a talk called Help, the Scrum Master is the Impediment.
Yeah,
it's one that I'm giving up in Canada later this year. And I love this talk because it's my own journey, and I needed a shrink going from a traditional, you know, PMP type project manager over to a scrum master. And it is a gut-wrenching experience. You reflect on your past career. You realize some of the damage you might have done on other projects and to other people. You see how you were not necessarily meeting needs, but doing some other things. And this role, you know, the agile coach as a psychologist is, I think, very appropriate. You know, if you read the last paragraph of Bob's post, it's, you know, so now I don't tout, sell, or give advice. I don't coach. I just try to listen, hold the space, empathize, do what I can to relate to people as fellow human beings, and walk together for a while as we pursue our journeys. And it's what we're supposed to be doing, right? When we go into an organization, we're just supposed to be the people who hold that space and help people step through the different doors as they learn more and more about what agility, and even take agility out, continuous improvement, what that looks like,
right,
and how to do, how to hold retrospectives about their practices, how to be introspective about their own behaviors, and then to be supportive when you have those moments of crisis, right? So you're a new scrum master and you're having this, you're trying to assign a task because that's what you've done for the last 5 years, and you have this internal crisis and you need someone to talk to, that's your coach. That's your agile coach. Mm-hmm. That's someone that you can go talk to and say, I have this reflex. I have this instinctive thing that I know is wrong, and I need to talk to you about it because I feel awful about it. Or, you know, even looking at an agile transformation, we're not putting new practices in. We're changing mindsets. And so you do need the shrink in the room to, if anything, just to listen. Like, I'm horrified of what this could lead to. I'm scared of what it does to my role in the company. Yeah. You know, as a project manager, you have a prominent role. You are the throat to choke on a project. You are the person who has all the information. You are needed. You are sought out. Now you're a scrum master. You're a servant. We have flipped your whole world on its ear, and you are now a servant to the developers who are now the prominent people on your project.
And that fear, Ryan, isn't just fear from the project manager, but I've heard executives state that fear, what's going to happen to our project managers.
Exactly.
Because they recognize that fear, and they don't see like an easy transition to the agile way of life for this whole group of middle managers.
Yeah, I've had this talk with quite a few. You know, there's a lot of us who have gone into organizations, taken full-time roles, and we spend a lot of our time talking to executives who are terrified of what Agile does to the org and what Agile will do to their PMO and what Agile will do to their current project managers. And there's no two-day class that prepares you for this.
Right.
The fact that, you know, John, our certifications don't address this at all. You know, we get through, and Victor, I know you're also
pretty deep in the acronyms. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, we all have alphabet soup after our names, and those. Mm-hmm. And I actually relayed that experience to a number of people that I understand the workings of Scrum at a very deep level, but how to actually comfort someone as they learn that process and what it means to them. I think most of us are novices, and it's another area that I think Bob Marshall is a pioneer. I appreciate his work, and I really hope there's a lot more in that area. Tobias Mayer is another person who is a thought leader in what people in focusing on the needs of people and on the true human side of what we're doing in Scrum and Agile. You know, even the Agile for Humans podcast is intentionally named that so that we remember the focus on people, right? We're not coaching ones and zeros in software, and we're not coaching a process. Mm-hmm. We are working directly with individuals, and those interactions have to be important, and they have to be handled with such care and to meet the needs of the people we're interacting with.
Exactly. Yeah, real well put.
I think that the temptation or the easiness of becoming distracted from that or feel that that's something that's unacceptable as part of the job description is large. And what I mean by that is, you know, as an embedded team coach with a very large client, I give, you know, a one-line accounting for what I've done with my day on site. And specifically what they're looking for is, what agile topics did you teach your team? Which, you know, is, if you contrast to everything that you've just said, you know, about help holding space for somebody that's going through a very challenging transformation, it's not easily cast into those terms. But by the same token, I think our fate as agile coaches on the earlier side of corporate adoption is one of being misunderstood by probably the sponsors and the people that are engaging you to some degree in the beginning, but that the more that you're spending time with the teams, the more that they actually do recognize that's your contribution. And sometimes it's simply a way of being, well, like, you know, Bob Marshall has described, listening as an active behavior is itself valuable and necessary for the transformation of mindsets and the growing of identities. And so It's a privilege and a challenge as a national coach to not be swept away by the more prevailing currents of corporate culture.
I want to just repeat that I wish that Zach Boniker had made this call. He recommended to a few of us the Reinventing Organizations book, the Lulu book, and I'm about a third of the way through it, and it's also got really great things to say about what it is, what our role is. And they don't even talk about Agile necessarily, but just the idea of the role of that coach in the very generic sense. What do you have to say? Use the hashtag TellAgileCoffee and let us know what you think the role of the coach is changing to. Our next topic is Agile Transformation, the rest of the story.
What I'm feeling with Agile Transformations is that there's been a lot written and said about Scrum teams or XP teams, Kanban teams, and what they need to do to, you know, become more effective and then more efficient and, you know, continuous improvement and all that towards being better at creating great software. And honestly, when it comes to Agile transformations, I don't think that that is more than 50% of the picture, which is to say, just as optimizing for the whole is absolutely essential and sub-optimization is actually orthogonal to that, we have to look at things like removing structural impediments that the team and the Scrum Master does not have the power or influence or social currency to affect on their own. And, you know, earlier in the podcast, we were talking about this angst that executives or middle-level management has about how their position might be affected by an Agile transformation. And to me, that's very ironic. And what I mean by that is the role or duties of an Agile manager or an Agile executive, if I can coin a phrase, is actually heightened by the Agile transformation in that they completely are deterministic in the success or failure of their side of it, which is systematically, transparently eliminating one after another of these structural impediments that are surfaced by introducing the Agile principles, values, and practices. So what I specifically mean by that is, in day-to-day terms, when you're working with the teams or the programs, or teams of teams, whatever you want to call it, and they have their retrospectives, and they find what they want to change, and then they identify the soup, which is Diana Larson's euphemism for structural impediments. You can set that soup aside and say, okay, team, I expect you guys to come out of this retrospective with an immediately actionable item that you can put into practice on a day-to-day basis that will make your processes better and you'll be a better team for it. However, if you're not accumulating a backlog of the soup or the structural impediments that have been identified, and if you're not actively escalating those to the powers that be all the way up to the CEO, and if they're not being tracked on some sort of an aging, you know, board, some sort of visual, big visible display, what's going to happen is that you have like this, you have this, it's almost like technical debt building up in your team, which is to say, we do not see a cause and effect relationship between our identifying structural impediments and the resolution thereof. Therefore, we are disempowered. Therefore, we cannot improve. therefore, agile transformation is a farce. Therefore, we will not be complicit. Therefore, we will not have retrospectives. And let's just stop talking about agile anyway. So I think that having some kind of formal ownership, transparent ownership of these structural impediments, which means rewriting bylaws of the organization, changing large, broad, vastly effective or applied practices that might be out of date or just might need to be tweaked a little bit, is absolutely valuable and essential to the organization. And it may not be apparent to the executives and managers, but they need to know this because it's the rest of the Agile transformation story. And I'm not saying that this is an easy nut to crack. I'm just saying that if you want to have a lasting transformation, you will have cracked it because it cannot be ignored. You can be delayed, but there won't be a transformation without it. You can't just like walk around this thing or sweep it under the rug. It's part and parcel of Agile transformation. So that's what I'm seeing as the rest of the story. And I'm looking for ways to try to engage the powers that be in an organization above the teams. And maybe, I don't know whether it's an awareness thing that we can do, or maybe it's a training thing, but the angst that executives and managers have about them not figuring into the picture is completely misguided and misunderstood. Because if they knew how much is at stake here that they can control collectively, I don't think that they would have such misgivings or concerns about being displaced with the Agile transformation.
So, John, there's a lot there, and this is one of my favorite topics. I do another talk. I just did this in Vegas a few months back called Coaching the Pointy-Haired Bosses to be Agile Enablers. And I love this talk, because the way that you framed up the problem it's a common frame up that I think resonates with a lot of Agile coaches. And at the same time, it puts the problem on the executive, that the executive is the one with the problem, which I disagree with. I think the Agile transformation team is the one that has to own this problem. And and the reason is that the executive, first of all, if the executive team is not bought into the transformation at least a high level, you're already set up for failure, and the coach really needs to be sounding off the blowhorn saying, no, this does not work. I mean, I can come in and teach your team's XP, but that's a software practice. If you want an agile transformation, you know, your C-level executive staff already need to have buy-in to what we're doing. Yep. So I think that's first and foremost. The other part, you know, you're talking about, which I agree with, management shifts to basically a system engineering type role. And that's not a programmer role. That's working on the systems of work that are in place that everyone else is impacted by. And so I think that's correct. But not all managers want to be system engineers. So they're very comfortable in the current structures that they've helped build. You know, the current software development lifecycle, the current political structure, the current, you know, circles of influence, all those things they've spent years and years building up and being promoted in and through and around, that's comfortable. And so they do have all of these structures that we're now saying, look, we're going to take all that away. Now, these are bright people. These are smart people, and they see the writing on the wall that the game's about to change. And there's a lot of issue there as well. And so what I have found is, let's just make the work visible. And this is why I'm a fan of Scrum, right? Scrum, for all its flaws, right? Let's push that aside. It's excellent at pointing out problems in your organization. It's excellent.
Yes.
And so when those are pointed out, those have to be owned. And I agree with you there. It's the ultimate system engineering tool. Make it visible. Show them the pain. Even more so, show them the cost. explain right. that the cost of this status report was X number of story points, which costed the whole organization, which cost the organization this feature in this sprint, which delayed revenue 2 to 4 weeks out. That's a real conversation with that level. Instead of, you're so unagile. This is not an agile practice. I don't know why we have to do this. This is not, you know, those kind of conversations, that works when we're talking. When we're talking to each other, fine. It's like, yeah, you're right. That's so not agile, man. But when you're talking to decision makers, you have to show them why it hurts. And that's, you know, as I progress in my career, I think, Victor, as you progress in yours, and John, I think we're all people with mobility, you know, and so we've moved into different roles, and right now mine's management. The thing that gets my attention most is the pain. This particular thing is stopping my team from delivering on a software project. Well, I need to get on the phone and take care of that, because that's going to have a definite cost, or a project overrun, or a missed date, or a missed commitment, or whatever it is that is going to be impacted. And the same goes for these executives who we're trying to work with during transformations. Let's treat them with respect. Let's frame the problem as our own. And then let's figure out a way to speak to them in such a manner that, first of all, the work is visible. The system is understood. The problem within the system is visible. And the impact is quantified in such a way that it has meaning and cannot be ignored.
Yes, I think that's the best approach. And as either a Scrum Master or Release Train Engineer or Program Manager, surfaces the problem and says, okay, this is what I want you to take away. There's always got to be a value proposition there, which is if you remove this impediment, then you'll have a value stream of this size, starting whatever it is you get around to removing the impediment. And maybe, as we talk about, system engineering for managers, there might be a way that you could gamify the removal of structural impediments, much in the way that Scrum has gamified the surfacing of impediments and delivery of incremental, iterative incremental software. And so what I'm saying is, what motivates many executives to take decisive action, which actually requires the changing of long-cherished policies, etc., usually has to do with recognition or prominence or a growth in social currency, in that political setting. And so, if it became very transparent specifically which executives or managers were successful in resolving specific impediments and what the value was to that, now all of a sudden that becomes part of their permanent track record with the enterprise, and there can be a very transparent comparison to who is solving the larger problems more frequently, and what that meant to the team that was impacted by it the most, or what have you, and giving rewards on top of that, that may or may not have a huge financial cost to the organization. So, anyways, giving incentives where they're actually sought for, which might be different to an executive compared to, say, a team member, I think could get more traction rather than getting up in our heads and saying, they should do this, and let the numbers speak for themselves. I'm a little bit skeptical that that has pronounced results, because I think that's what we've been saying we're going to do in Scrum. I've been reading about this in another book by Ken Schwaber, where we say, that's what they do. Scrum has two purposes. Surfaces these problems, and what the enterprise decides to do about it is their business, and it's up to the CEO as the product owner of the entire organization to expect progress on this. Well, how much of a mechanism is in place to actually incentivize people to take risks by publicly taking on some policy or some long-standing practice? I would guess that it's not enough, because I don't see a lot of organizations just going gangbusters on long lists of structural impediments. But it could be out there. I'd love to hear from a listener that says, oh, no, we've been doing that for decades. But I think that that's what, you know, when we look at the benefits of Scrum or Agile, I think that that's what lies directly in front of them, is that, yeah, the team transforms, the team adopts these practices that surface the issues. But where they go from there is the real killer question.
Well, and it's back to a lot of the conversation we've had tonight, is that we've got to give them the same respect, time, and space to get to that same conclusion that's so natural to people like us who have been looking at this for the last 10 years.
Yes, that's true.
Tell Agile Coffee. Let us know how, if and how, you've gone ahead and tracked these structural impediments or gotten buy-in to address them along the way. John had mentioned gamification a couple of minutes back, which brings us to our final topic of the night, which is that of Agile games. And when I say Agile games, I don't just mean games, but also, I guess you could call them to be pedantic simulations or learning activities as well. And I think this is more of a fun topic. It's not as heavy, I think, as some of the other topics we've had, but it's just, in my opinion, kind of a listing of some of the games that I use, that we've used with our teams, whether it's in an early portion of a transformation or kind of as a refresher maybe along the way, that go ahead and reinforce some of the lean or agile values, the benefits of working in this way. And so I threw this topic out there because I'm talking with someone in the next couple of days who's got to go and conduct a training, and he asked me to kind of give him some guidance on what games he might want to use. So I've come up with about, you know, four or five games that I use pretty often, and I wanted to hear you guys' feedback on if there's any other games. So I'm just going to spend a minute or two just kind of overviewing the games that I'm going to share with him. First of all is this game called Multitasking, and I'm not sure if these games have other names, but this is what I'm calling them. So multitasking basically, you know, shows how multitasking reduces effectiveness. So each player can play by themselves as, you know, at their desk with a piece of paper. And they, in this case, they take a piece of paper, they form three columns, and they, in the first column, they write the first 10 letters of the alphabet, A through J. And then the second column, they write 1 through 10, the regular Arabic numerals, and then finally the Roman numerals 1 through 10 in the third column. But they write them, as you're probably familiar, in across rows. So they would write A, and then the number 1, and then the Roman numeral 1, and then go back to B, the number 2, the Roman numeral 2, all the way down. That's the first iteration, and they time themselves. And the second iteration is basically the same thing, only instead of switching between forms, they would write A through J, and then 1 through 10, as we're familiar with them, and then 1 through 10 in Roman numerals. So you can see how quickly you can get done faster in the second way of doing it. So that's the first game. Next is collaborative origami. So you divide the group up into kind of teams of two, but you have three different groups of them. The first group is face-to-face working. I'm sorry, the first group is working side by side so that one person is the folder and the other person gives them the directions of how to do the origami, and the folder can see the directions. The second one, they're face to face. The folder can't see the directions, but the person guiding them can tell them what they need to do. And the third one is back to back. So it illustrates the importance of kind of face to face versus distributed communication. Then the penny flip game, which I'm not going to describe, but that emphasizes the value of small batches and process improvements. The ballpoint game, I think we're also all familiar with, which teaches teamwork, also process improvements. And that's with a big, big group. And then something called the human knot, which I wasn't familiar with up until about a year, 6 or 8 months ago, which is, again, a large group of people kind of standing together in a room. It has to be, I believe it's an even number of people, and it teaches self-organization. So those are five games. Are you guys familiar with each of those games that I mentioned? And what comments do you have about those games, or do you have any other games that you like?
I'm familiar with the games that you've mentioned, and a lot of them, or some of them anyways, are built into the Agile training that I've either received or that my current employer offers. And I guess, you know, the ideas that I have around their value are that they're much more instructive on a deeper level than most people probably realize. And what I mean by that is that I've heard people say, oh, well, games are just something that you put into your curriculum for when people come back from lunch and are about to go into sugar coma. You get them to stand up, they get 18% more oxygen to their brain, and then they learn something while having fun and sit down. I think that there's a lot more to it than that. Much in the way people point out that Jesus taught in parables because of the multiple applicability and the timelessness and the integration of symbols into stories and the way that our brains process information through stories, the game is a way of creating a metaphor for learning that will help people understand how to work together on several levels at the same time. I think that some games are more valuable than others, and that when you're really skilled at using Agile games is when you can identify the most painful point of lack of understanding that a group has and introduce a game that reduces this point to very understandable terms that you learn through doing rather than hearing or saying, and can implement that. And I've seen Agile coaches that can make up games on the fly. Agile games, just it comes to their mind and they introduce it to a group and it becomes like a new practice. And there's a huge, you know, directory of Agile games out there nowadays, several of them, I guess.
Right.
So, you know, if those games happen to be applicable to the group that, you know, this friend of yours is working with, then great. But I would say knowing where to go to find games that are relevant to your group is probably the best thing to have in mind. And maybe
yeah, I've shared the resource. I've shared the resource. You know, Tasty Cupcakes is one website that just about everyone knows. I've got these games on my own website, agilecoffee.com/games. You can find out more there. But John, you and I had talked in previous episodes, or maybe offline, mm-hmm. in both cases, about the use of improvisation. And
sure.
I think the more that you use these games and the more familiar you are with improvisation as well, the more likely you are to do just as you said, kind of pull out the right game at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not playing games for game's sake. You don't want any – certainly the last thing you want is to tell everyone, hey, we're going to play games today and have the executive team come in and mm-hmm. say, oh, they're just playing games. That's all they're doing. But rather you're using the game as a learning opportunity, as you're saying, and you're using kind of the game as an excuse to teach about, to do that unpacking of, okay, what are the lessons that we learned from that game and how do they apply to our real life, our working lives?
Yeah. And I think, you know, much in the way that, war games, are ways of practicing military activity without suffering casualties. You could say that Agile games are ways of practicing good software development practices without casualties because it's just a game. It's not you targeting somebody's position or making comments about the relative value of one position's contribution to the team. And so kind of blurring the context a little bit and taking individuals out of it is one of the advantages of games. It lets you diffuse some of the political tension that normally encapsulates some of the learnings that we're trying to bring to people's awareness. And so, that's an area that, like, for those, of you that are creating games out there, agile games out there, might want to focus your efforts, I would say, look for the political tension in a team and find a game, a way of making a game that uses a metaphor that brings them out of their context enough so that they're not thinking of themselves or a specific individual, and that we can just focus on what is so rather than what somebody did or who should or shouldn't be a member of the team, etc. Because it's the truth that helps us progress and become better teams. It's not criticizing or placing blame that makes us a better team. Games will help.
I think getting back to a regular theme of our conversation tonight is, are we meeting a need? And the game should meet the need of the team at the moment that need is recognized. And so, like you guys are saying, the gameplay for the sake of gameplay isn't necessarily good, but the need being met certainly is. I like the penny game that Victor brought up. And actually, a friend of mine, she used that game, modified slightly, because people in her organization did not understand the role of the product owner. They thought it was business as usual. Here's the requirements. Go do it. And they modified the game a bit. They added in nickels, dimes, and quarters to add a new dimension, right? So on the first iteration, the first sprint, whatever you want to call it, let's not a semantical issue, but let's say on the first sprint, the person running the game basically said, "Oh, I only want results with heads up," and everyone's like, "All right," scratching their heads a bit. The next iteration, she only accepted shiny coins, so everyone assumed it was dimes, nickels, and quarters, but the dimes were excluded because they were too small. All these different things, just showing what a product owner could do, and finally got the team working with that product owner. When she finally made an outrageous request, the team finally responded, "That's a great request, throw it on the backlog, we're busy working on this iteration." And when that aha moment hit, they just stopped the game. They said, "All right, this interaction is something we want to pull out and work on and discuss." And that's where I see the gamification really being valuable. And if you don't know the penny game, I'm sorry, that won't make sense to you, but it's worth learning, just not necessarily for what I just said, but just as a learning tool for your teams. But that moment was then pulled out of that context, used as a whole team learning moment, the learning amplified, and everyone just understood that the PO is now embedded in this team. It's a back and forth. It's not a, "Here's my requirements, go build it," that there's a true collaboration, and that moment solidified that lesson for the people impacted. It was a really powerful moment, and for me, changed my opinion on the role of games in the work that we do, because I wasn't always a fan. Shamed to admit it, but it just hadn't always clicked. But once I saw that moment or heard about that moment happening, it just solidified it for me that this is an important part of the work that we do.
I think John's familiar as well with Brian Beecham's Lego TDD game, and that's something that I learned. I saw him perform early on when he was developing it. But again, it's a way to teach test-driven development, in this case, to a group of people who aren't necessarily developers, and just show them the rationale, like why Kent Beck and these people who are busy developing these new ways of work, why developing in this way is so critical for us. And it was a game. And so it got people engaged and they played it and they laughed about it and stuff. But then you could see why developers, it makes more sense for developers to use TDD in this case. And again, it's a way of getting you out of your normal rational space of thinking of things and learning things a different way so that the subconscious can consume it and internalize it. Fun stuff.
That's a good point, Vic, about how games, because they're a metaphor for something that's more technologically sophisticated, that it makes the principles of Agile, or at least the practices, accessible to people who don't necessarily make software, but maybe make very important decisions about the financing of software development. And then finally, I just had a recommendation to make, and that is that in the situation where maybe the participants of your game are not inferring the lessons that you intended for it, mid-game, like the penny game that Ryan mentioned, because I would agree, once they've gotten the learning, you can stop and go on with, making software
right.
or training. But if they're not getting it, I've seen how after the game, having a fishbowl exercise to retrospect on the game just pulls all of these learnings out of it and makes it plain for everybody. And as a coach or a trainer, it's so much more valuable to have them say it than for you to say it. If they discover it and infer it from the game, then it's theirs forever. And that's true for them, on and on. Whereas if you say it, well, then that's just something that you thought, might be relevant to them or not. And the likelihood that, their own effective filter, their internal voice will just say, so what? Or maybe yes, maybe no. So allowing them to find the learning is important and valuable and actually easy to do with a follow-on retrospective like the fishbowl.
Well, guys, I think that brings us to the end of this topic. And we've gone through a number of topics. And for the regular listeners of the Agile Coffee podcast, if you're still with us, kudos, because this is probably our longest episode. And for those of Ryan's listeners to the Agile for Humans podcast, thanks for tuning in tonight and getting a sense of what it is that we do when we talk on the Agile Coffee podcast. John Jorgensen has been, and I just want to take a moment to kind of call out John, because he's been coming to our face-to-face meetups. When I started doing the Lean Coffees back in 2012, I think John might have come in that year, if not certainly early in 2013. And John was really instrumental in getting the podcast itself off the ground. So listeners, if you're not familiar with the Agile Coffee podcast, first of all, I thank you for listening to this one today. And I invite you to come back and check out some of the previous ones, because John is John's one of my favorite guests. And tonight was definitely no exception. I want to thank Ryan also for getting us together. Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you, Victor. It's been a lot of fun. We've talked a little bit before this show that usually I'm doing your role that you filled tonight. I'm facilitating. I'm trying to keep the questions flowing and keeping the conversation going. And tonight it was a real pleasure to be able to sit back, just add to the conversation, weave in and out of the topics with you and John, and really enjoyed it. And would love to do it again. To the listeners of Agile for Humans, please check out Victor's podcast, the Agile Coffee podcast. A lot of great content in there. Zach Boniker, who's becoming a fixture on Agile for Humans, participates quite a bit. John is also there. A lot of good content, a lot of different topics, very diverse, a wide range of topics and participants, and always keeps it fresh and interesting. And just thank you if you've made it this far. This was a long one for us too, but I hope at least a few of these topics have provided some great value for you.
John, any final words?
I'm just looking forward to the next Agile Coffee, quite frankly. it's been a long diversion. As you know, some of the involvement that I've had with some local charities when I am in town. But I realize, things in the Agile community have have progressed, and there's just so many more ideas out there to get exposure to. As one listener, I'm really looking forward to the future episodes of both podcasts, and would love to participate, just, you know, even on the offline meetings, one lucky Saturday. So thank you for having me, both Ryan and Victor.
So John Jorgensen can be reached on Twitter at WaterScrumbon. Ryan Ripley is on Twitter at Ryan Ripley. That's R-I-P-L-E-Y is the spelling of his last name. My name is Victor Bonacci. I can be reached on Twitter at Agile Coffee.
Great time. Really loved being on here. Glad that both of our audiences get to know the other shows, and, you know, just love promoting the Agile podcasting community, and hopefully everyone's enjoyed this and they check out our archives, and we continue to bring value to the people that trust us with their time and humble us with their feedback and emails and all of their great notes. So thanks again.